Hello, I'm Jason Solomons, and welcome back to Film Weekly. The Oscar nominations are out. It's The Hurt Locker versus Avatar with 9 nominations each as Kathryn Bigelow goes head-to-head with her ex-husband. What's his name? Oh yeah, James Cameron. Zan Brooks and I cast our eyes over the nominations and make some predictions for the big night on March the 7th. And we also talk to British nominee Armando Iannucci. Back in the 1980s, Linda Hamilton kicked the action heroine into touch with her role as the hard-as-steel Sarah Connor in Terminator. This week, she's back on the big screen playing hardball again, but this time it's for laughs in the twinkly Irish comedy Holy Water. Linda Hamilton joins us in the Film Weekly studio to discuss typecasting, Terminator, and her ex-husband. What's his name? Oh yeah, Jim Cameron. Also, we'll be reviewing Man of the Moment, Michael Cera, alongside himself in split personality rom-com, Youth in Revolt, and the Oscar-nominated Morgan Freeman and Oscar-nominated Matt Damon star in Invictus, a tale of rugby and racial reconciliation in post-apartheid South Africa. Oh, it's better than an up and under. It's Film Weekly. Linda Hamilton is an actor who recast the role of the female hero in the action genre. As Sarah Connor in the Terminator films, she imbued her character with such physicality and power, she held her own against the on-screen might of Arnold Schwarzenegger. Hamilton is back this week, complete with muscles, glare and rasp, riffing on her iconic past for comic effect.
4-man crew?
Two of them are disguised as road workers. The other two are dressed in nuns' habits.
Drivers identify the hardware?
Guns?
Oh, they said that the 4 hijackers were heavily armed.
Stetson.
That sounds like the Russian mob.
No, we can't be sure until we investigate the crime scene.
And one of your people, Mooney.
That'll be me, eh?
Overheard the hijackers on the phone speaking in a foreign language.
They sounded foreign, but I'm just not...
And the drivers confirmed activating the transponder?
They did indeed.
Anything else?
One of the nuns had a hairy arse.
That was Stanley Townsend there as Inspector Hogan and Linda Hamilton as the ice-cool head of Sterling Security. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined in the Film Weekly studio by Linda Hamilton herself. Welcome to Film Weekly, Linda.
Thank you.
How lovely to see you. Thank you very much for coming in. And thank you so much for supporting this little film. I don't know why I'm thanking you. I'm not one of the producers or one of the stars, but it must have been sort of a shock for them to have you in it and a shock for the shoot to have you arrive as it is in the film. You know, they're all kind of like, oh, who's coming? And it's you.
Yes, it was me. I just loved the script, thought it was perfect. And, you know, sometimes it's not about the character you're playing so much as just the project. It was so great. And sort of harkens back to a sweeter, simpler time and a simpler tale. And those need to be told, too.
Yeah,
sometimes
absolutely.
We just want a sweet little tale with wonderful characters, and that's what we've got here.
Yeah, I don't think people would associate you necessarily with sweet little tales. No, no offense to you, but your grand film oeuvre, particularly T1 and T2, are not sweet little tales.
No, and in this one... I don't particularly play one of the sweet, kind characters either. You know, my job is to be the beast again. So, you know, it would give the young men in our cast something to push against. So, you know, I play the scary American, the ugly, ugly, ugly American who comes in with all the toys and technology and, you know, scares the bejesus out of our gang of thieves.
People always talk about when they do shoot in Ireland that literally, because that you shoot in small villages or whatever, that normally the kind of post-shoot recreation does take place in the pub. There is Guinness involved.
Oh, yes. And actually, we used Devon as the countryside of Devon as Ireland.
Really?
I think
you
it was an economic decision. And it certainly works on film. And I can't say anything against Devon. I loved it. But, you know, I love Ireland.
Oh, okay. No, I mean, you completely fooled me. I'm no Devon expert, but I really thought you were there.
Mm-hmm.
It must have been the accents that got me.
Yes.
And tell us briefly about your character then in this. She is head of the security operation, but she's quite tough. I mean, that's what we expect of you.
True.
I know.
And, you know, hopefully I won't always play tough because there is a whole lot more to me than tough.
Well, clearly.
Actually, I'm not that tough, but no one would believe that at this point. But my character in this film is the investigator. The story revolves around the foolish notion that these four gentlemen have of heisting a lorry, of hijacking a lorry full of Viagra and taking it to Amsterdam to sell it at $9 a pop so they can just sort of economically recover from, you know, what's going on all over. And they're in a town where nothing has happened for centuries, and it is so rural. And out of foolish, you know, dumb luck, they get this truck, and there's nowhere to even hide it because we're in the middle of nowhere. So they take the truck and put it in the old widow's barn, think that they've gotten away with it. And then the drug company sends its big guns from the U.S. and they find out that what they've stolen is worth $63 million, and they are in so far over their heads. So they take the water, they take the Viagra, and they put it down an adjunct into the town well. And of course, we know, we can guess what happens.
Exactly.
Containers break open. We've got a whole town on Viagra.
There are queues around the block for the confessional booth.
Yes, yeah, yes. The parish priest has never been busier.
when you did the Terminator movies, particularly T2 as well, which I think, you know, everyone of a certain generation has you burned on their retinas from then, Linda. In a way, because you sort of said, well, there is a lot more to you than those kind of tough roles, but you did sort of put a stamp on the female acting at the time. You kind of changed the game, really. Everyone had to go and work out because of you.
That's a good thing.
Was it a good thing? Was that a conscious decision to sort of change the aesthetic, if you like, of the action?
Well,
heroine?
No, I don't think that anyone ever really plans, you know, or counts on becoming an icon like that. And no one was more surprised than I was when that happened, where the physique and the fitness and all of that sort of eclipsed 95% of the real work that I had done to play that part. But, you know, you don't find me complaining.
No,
you
absolutely.
Know, it was quite wonderful to, you know, even in the early days where people were just, you know, just so smitten with Sarah Connor, I was stunned because my idea of Sarah Connor is that she's a woman living in hell, you know, with the certainty of the future coming her way, you know. And it was such a tortured character that I couldn't imagine that anyone would want to emulate on any level. So, you know, I was quite shocked at the attention that I got.
Do you feel preparatorial towards the character? Do you have to let her go at certain points?
You know, there was a long time where I was really just really so wanted to let her go because I felt that it might have been restricting my further roles as we went along. After that, I was offered police officers, military officers, and lesbian. That's all.
Yeah.
You would think that a strong performance would lead people, especially the people that make movies, into, you know, oh, she's really good, let's put her in something else. But really, they were quite corridor-minded about my capabilities after that.
And
I would have to go into a director and earn a role that was normal. I mean, I had directors say to me, well, you've never played a part like this. And I would say, what do you mean? And they would say, you know, normal. I would say, well, you know, I could probably handle that since I've done so much outside of that. Normal probably is okay.
When did you get to a point where you could accept that? Because it must take a few years.
Quite a few years. I mean, I really, really struggled, you know, on every level. I just, you know, my hair was platinum. My hair was short and red. I mean, anything but long, dark blonde hair, you know, just to create a different image for people so that they could get past the Sarah Connor.
And did you think of gaining weight? Becoming enormous?
I actually...
Waddling along? That would have stopped them.
Because, you know, there's a big call for fat, fat, fat actresses in our world. Actually, I did play a woman that was completely eaten up by AIDS and lost a huge amount of weight.
You got nominations for that part, though, didn't you?
I did actually win an award for that. I did, and I got a Golden Globe nomination, and that was kind of wonderful. So I think, you know, it is our privilege as actors to get to transform, and if that meant gaining weight, that would be fine. If it means losing weight, I will do it.
It seems that now that we've got that Jim Cameron has since gone on to do Titanic, obviously, and Avatar, Just quickly, obviously, since yesterday, the Oscar nominations are out.
Yeah.
He's got 9 nominations as well. You're still in touch with
absolutely.
With Jim and,
well, we have a daughter.
Yes.
So we are in touch. I had Christmas dinner with Jim.
Right. And you've seen Avatar, I take it?
Twice. And I paid
in
both times.
Did you see it in
Jim,
3D twice, or have you seen it in 2D
and
3D?
IMAX 3D twice.
Right. And this is and what do you see when you think of that work? Can you kind of say, well, that's amazing that it's Jim's work and I'm so integral to part of his life? Or can you watch it and kind of just get completely subsumed by it?
I do get completely subsumed, and that's actually a statement about how good the film is. And I had read that script while we were married, as a matter of fact, and it was one of 3 or 4 projects. Several projects came in between, my marriage to Amanda 12 years ago after Titanic, but there were quite a few things that he was getting ready to do. He was going to do the Spider-Man franchise. He was going to do a really great script about multiple personality disorder. Avatar, to me, was like the third favorite. I read it and just thought, and that goes to show you that I should never be directing, making movies. But I wasn't sure that it was going to have an audience. And that doesn't, a great film can be a great film, but if there's no audience for it, and I just thought, who's going to want to see this movie? Is it the comic cartoon fans? Is it young kids? And, you know, it didn't necessarily say anything to me, but Jim obviously saw something. Way beyond what was there on the page.
Yeah, but
even now
people sort of say, well, I don't really fancy that movie. They see the trailers for it and it's
right.
Like people with tails and blue people and you think, that's not really my thing. But I mean, me too. I mean, film critics always say I have to see it, but I didn't really fancy it. And as soon as it started, I was like, wow,
yes,
I'm in.
It's just like taking a wonderful vacation, far, far, far away.
And you guys have got it sewn up on the extended Cameron family, got it sewn up on us tonight. It's Catherine and Bigelow's film.
I know.
Is
I'm rooting for the ex-wives here.
Yeah, I mean, is there a club?
Ex-wives club.
But they might reward studios for kind of being so brave with something like Avatar and then give Catherine the best director because she'd be the first woman ever to do that. And
that would be great, too.
Sister-wise, ex-wives, you've got to be on the side of that.
But I would hate to receive an award because I'm the first woman. Do you know what I mean? I would hate for that to be, it was a sentimental thing because it was time that a woman won. I'm sure Catherine would say the same.
Yeah, but the one thing that you could never accuse Catherine Bigelow's film of is sentimental. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. But in terms of sentimentality, awards-wise.
Yeah, that Jim Gay likes a strong woman, does that James Cameron? I'm seeing a
He likes strong women.
and of course, Ripley, the woman I think that Sarah Connor kind of out-muscled as kind of tough heroines he's got in Avatar.
Yes, he does.
And then, of course, the guy that runs Los Angeles is you've got it sewn up there. You know the governor, Inani? You still in touch with him?
It's true. It's funny how much cachet I got after Arnold ran for governor. Suddenly, I was like the first lady. People were coming to me for my political opinions because I'm a friend of Arnold's. It was very interesting. And, it is still interesting. I mean, he's got 1 year left. But
there's not going to be a
T5,
is there?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. When I did the bit in the studio, the audio part that I did for the fourth one, he was talking about a fifth one.
But he makes a little, Arnold makes a little cameo in 4.
Well, you know what? I'm not sure that Arnold was there at all.
Oh, okay.
I think that might have been digital and someone else's body.
Amazing what they can do these
days
in the
movies. Isn't it?
Hamilton.
I mean, I didn't learn that till later. I thought, Arnold. But, I mean, it was pretty seamless. But I'm not sure that Arnold really made an appearance in that film.
But if there was a T5, then you could have you back.
He's free to roam.
Linda Hamilton, amazing that to talk about these great effects-driven movies, which you've sort of been such a part of, and then to come to do Holy Water, which has not a single effect shot in it, I think the whole thing, really.
No.
Completely lo-fi charm. That you've lent, and then you lend this kind of muscle to it. So congratulations on that, and thank you so much for coming into Film Weekly, and good luck on the Ex-Wives Club backstage on Oscar night.
Thank you so much.
And Holy Water is on general release in the UK from Friday the 5th of February. And joining me to review this week's cinema releases is a man who needs no chemical help in his love life, The Guardian critic Zan Brooks.
You need divine intervention.
Let's kick off then with Invictus, which has earned Oscar nominations for its actors Morgan Freeman and Matt Damon.
Part sports movie, part political thriller, Clint Eastwood directs this stirring tale of Nelson Mandela and his conviction that South African success in the 1995 Rugby World Cup would shape a positive future for his vision of a rainbow nation.
I remember when I was invited to the 1992 Olympics in Barcelona. Everybody in the stadium greeted me with a song. At the time, the future, our future, seemed very bleak. But to hear that song in the voices of people from all over our planet made me proud to be South African. It inspired me to come home and do better. It allowed me to expect more of myself.
May I ask, what was the song, sir?
Well, it was in Nkosi Sikelel' Afrika. A very inspiring song. We need inspiration, Francois. Because in order to build our nation, we must all exceed our own expectations.
Morgan Freeman as Nelson Mandela and Matt Damon as Springbok Captain Francois Pienaar. Zan, did Invictus inspire you to better things?
That remains to be seen. I'm still in the doldrums, the moral turpitude. But there's actually, it's like a double whammy of inspiration in this film, isn't it? It's because you've got Nelson Mandela fresh out of Robben Island and the newly elected president of South Africa. And then you've got the Springboks rugby team who have been languishing in the doldrums but are about to press forward to the 1995 Rugby World Cup finals. So this is guaranteed inspiration. And yet, having said all that, I found this a bit flat.
It is a bit flat. It's one of Clint Eastwood's things, him and his cinematographer Tom Stern. They do that flat office light very well. I mean, there's a lot of this film that is basically just people walking in and out of each other's office and asking for things. But I actually enjoyed that little look into beside the corridors of power, that handover, to use a rugby term, between the old power of white and the new power of black. I was slightly surprised at how fascinating I found it.
Much is made of that, and it is in itself fascinating. You've got the old white security staff who now have to work alongside the black security staff who presumably they were beating up with nightsticks just a few months before. So obviously there's that edgy reconciliation going on and the mistrust on both sides. And I think that Morgan Freeman does actually give a very rounded performance as Mandela. I don't think he looks much like him, but he nails the accent and gives a sense of a hint at the private man behind the public face. There's the wonderful scene where he's always solicitously asking his staff about their family. How's your wife? How are your children? But then when one of them turns the tables on him and asks him, he freezes and can't cope with that.
We're in that kind of hallowed territory that modern cinema is entering, where in the Frost-Nixon territory, where the great lives of real men are then brought sort of to the fore by actors interpreting sort of recent history, and you get a peek behind into their human kind of maelstrom.
You do, and yet at the same time, I think that this is more of a monument than a motion picture. It's kind of what you'd expect Clint Eastwood to do with this story. He admires Mandela, and he makes a very admiring film about him. Because of that, it felt a little bit stiff, a little bit lethargic. There was nothing here that takes you by surprise.
Next up, we turn to a film featuring another Francois, though of a far more dubious character. Michael Cera, that geeky pup of an indie heartthrob, plays awkward teen Nick Twisp, who invents for himself a mustachioed new wave rebel alter ego called Francois Dillinger, intent on advising Nick how to get his dream girl.
What are those for?
You and I are going to find a nice quiet parking lot and set this baby on fire.
I thought we were going to wreck it.
Use your head. No sense getting killed for a girl.
We need to take a minute and consider our actions and what the consequences will be.
Listen, asshole. You've been making all the decisions for 16 years, and look at where you are. I'm here to rescue you from yourself. So just be quiet and let me blow some shit up.
Double trouble there, Zan. Do you think Michael Cera pulls this one off?
It's the old Woody Allen trick, isn't it? It's the play it against Sam routine, whereby a nerdy character basically concocts the great, cool, fictional alter ego who more often than not leads him down the path to sort of bad deeds, and in this case a crime spree to impress the teenager that he meets at the restless Axels trailer park where they've all gone on holiday. It does kind of work. I kind of like this.
I did as well. It strikes me that Sarah, who I think is sort of the indie pinup at the moment after Juno, but he's also becoming a sort of Woody Allen substitute because there was that Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, which found him sort of having an affair through the night in Manhattan, which was very Manhattanish, Annie Hallish. And again, he's really kind of, there's even a joke in this film that is completely nicked from Sleeper, where a car kind of comes down a cliff and lands in a kind of puddle rather than a lake. But I think it's tapping into something worthwhile, that kind of the modern geek that, you know, comes around every generation.
I think you're right. The million-dollar question with Michael Cera is, what is he going to be doing this when he's 30, when he's 40? I mean, Woody Allen kind of developed, maybe was a much later starter. Michael Cera, I think, is now early mid-20s, but he's still kind of playing 15, 16. He's maybe a one-note actor, but it's a note that he plays absolutely beautifully, the sort of cerebral, diffident, geeky nerd.
There are nice bits at the beginning where Sarah and his new love kind of trade quips about Serge Gainsbourg or whether they like Tokyo Story, he says, and then he says, and Mizugochi's famous, and she says, well, I think that was Ozu, and he says, who can tell? There's that nice play, I think, that makes this film, if I was 12, 13, I'd probably really love this.
I think so,
one of
yeah.
My favourite films.
It's based on a novel that I haven't read. It's directed by Miguel Arteta, who is, I think, a very talented director. He did a great film about 10 years ago called Chuck and Buck, which was much darker than this. This is more lightweight. It's kind of episodic. It's whimsical. But it is funny, and I think Sarah is a kind of endlessly engaging presence. He's somebody that I'm always happy to see in a movie. I do worry about him when he's older. He's got to learn something else. He's got to grow up eventually.
Zan, our final film, takes us to northern Russia's White Sea, where Pavel Lunguin's The Island tells of a hermetic monk played by Russian rock star Pyotr Mamonov, whom locals believe has healing and foretelling gifts. However, his own soul is still tortured by a guilty secret buried deep in Russia's past. Zan, do you see a future for the island?
I think I see a bleak future, which is entirely fitting. I think I see warm reviews, a very swift death in the theatres, and maybe a kind of middling afterlife on DVD.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I found this extremely hard going, this film. I mean, it doesn't kind of get to the Russian kind of heights of Tarkovsky, which I'm sure it owes a much of a debt to. And even that wonderful film by Zviagintsev, the one at Venice a few years ago called The Return, with which it bears quite a strong resemblance. That was set on an island, and it seems to be about the mysteries of a past as well.
This is more of a mishmash, though, isn't it? It's not quite going for the celestial art house rigor story of faith and redemption and struggle. It kind of is, but then it's got this sort of lugubrious black humour going through it where the monk is sort of playing pranks on people and is a bit of a kind of a weirdo oddball as well. And so it tries to have a bit of fun with that as well. So I felt that I was being kind of shunted around in terms of my response to this, whether you're supposed to kind of worship at the altar of this very highbrow, stark film, or see it as almost like a little riff on those themes.
I couldn't work out if it was sort of taking the mickey out of the Russian austerity, because there are a few sort of moments of, I mean, humour. I wouldn't say it's sort of
laugh out
loud.
No, it's Russian humour.
It really is. And there's also a prologue, which is actually sort of almost quite exciting, and I thought this is going to be really good.
Yeah, they really pull the rug out of us, don't they, with that. I mean, I was thinking, oh, thriller, World War II, he has to shoot someone, and then that's all junked. And of course, he's scarred by it all. But the rest of the film takes a very different course.
And now, I'm not an aficionado of Russian rock music, but I'm told that Pyotr Mamonov is the sort of Mick Jagger of Russian rock and roll. His performance as the monk, hard to tell, though, it is under all that soot.
Yeah, there's a lot of... he pushes a wheelbarrow very well, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He makes tea. He stands in the snow. I mean, maybe this is great acting, and particularly great rock star acting. I don't know. I thought he was okay, but I don't think Mick Jagger's got anything to worry about.
Gabourey Sidibe in Precious, and Meryl Streep in Julie and Julia.
The nominees for Best Performance by an Actor in a Leading Role are Jeff Bridges in Crazy Heart, George Clooney in Up in the Air, Woo! Colin Firth in A Single Man, Morgan Freeman in Invictus.
The pristine Anne Hathaway and Academy President Tom Sherrack there announcing the nominations for the 82nd Academy Awards, the Oscars to you and me. Zan, let's take some of the main categories and see what we think. But overall, what was your first impression of those 10 Best Picture nominees?
10 Best Picture nominees for the first time in 60-odd years. I thought it wasn't a bad spread. I think that there were films that didn't make it that people thought might, like The Hangover, which won a Golden Globe. Star Trek, which was, I think, seen as one of the big crowd-pleasing blockbusters that had a bit of brains to it, and that didn't make it either.
But it's still a bit rubbish, isn't it?
I kind of like Star Trek.
Yeah, but it's not an Oscar nomination. You don't ruin, I don't know, 85 years.
You can't argue Oscar nominations on quality alone.
It's no Driving Miss Daisy.
Exactly. A few films are, thank heavens. But I thought it was a pretty good list. I'm glad to see A Serious Man in there, your favourite from last year.
I was so pleased. That so got the Jewish vote. I was so pleased that Jewish lobby, which I think is a literal lobby, like full of like shouting Jews, like Harvey Weinstein, just like there going, nah, 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 as you walk along this lobby. I think they obviously got that vote.
Apparently they have influence in Hollywood.
It's a rumour. I couldn't possibly say. But no, I was delighted to see that because it's sort of, in all the kind of advanced buzz, that had been overlooked. They were going to say, well, they'll get the Coens a screenplay, which they always do to films that are sort of
too smart,
too clever, got some writing in them.
Yeah.
But I thought The Barrel might have been well and truly scraped there. I mean, if The Hangover had got in there, which I do like, I think it's a funny film. But
It's not your best picture, though.
No,
is it?
It's not. So ultimately, the 10 best pictures, I did suspect that maybe a documentary might get in there, or a foreign language film.
If you're really opening it out and you're basically saying, now we can do the foreign language films, but they didn't. They dropped the ball on that one. So you've still got The White Ribbon and A Prophet fighting out in the foreign language category.
Yeah, don't forget, last year we also had in that category, I think it was Gomorrah and Waltz with Bashir, and they didn't win it. The Japanese film Departures, which, without even seeing, predicted would win.
Yeah, I've got a lot to live up to this year, haven't I, with my predictions?
Well, there is a film in there which I haven't seen called The Secret of Her Eyes, which is Argentina's biggest domestic hit since 1970, and is about pensioners. And I know that the foreign film voters are mainly in the elder category. So, and I think this is a real
crowd. Which was the Departures argument.
Yeah.
Because it's all about people dying. And you think, well, they're going to die soon,
yeah, absolutely.
So may as well vote for it.
Exactly. It's a good thing to do. I'm fully behind it. So we've got to watch out for The Secret of Her Eyes from Argentina. But I mean, really, I think A Prophet and The White Ribbon are both better than probably all of those films.
I think they are. So that's maybe where the real interest for quality lies. Obviously, in terms of the fireworks, it's a battle between The Hurt Locker and Avatar, both of which have 9 nominations. And obviously, for the human interest angle, it's directed by an ex-husband and wife who are now fighting it out.
Yeah, who gets custody of the Oscar, people say.
Wouldn't it be great if they got back together?
In a kind of gold-covered loving.
Yeah, maybe like live at the Oscar telecast.
Do you think that's why she left him or he left her? Because he shouts at the moment of climax, I'm king of the world.
That would put anybody off,
wouldn't
surely.
It? Absolutely. Now, do you think Bigelow will be the first woman director to carry off the Best Director prize?
I think she will. I think that about a month ago, all the momentum seemed to be with Avatar when it cleaned up at the Golden Globes. I think since then, The Hurt Locker has won the Producers Award and the Directors Award, which seem ostensibly to be kind of minor awards, but actually a much more interesting pointers and reliable pointers towards the Oscar. And I think there is a sense that, you know, a woman has never won it. A woman's only been nominated for Best Director something like 4 times.
Yeah.
And, you know, put all that aside, it's a fantastically directed film. It's superbly directed. So I think she deserves it.
Yeah, and it's beautifully orchestrated. I would like to sort of see Cameron get a bit of a slap in the face. I wouldn't mind Avatar winning Best Picture, but I think if he only gets 2 or 3 awards, that would be a real smack.
Avatar surely doesn't need any more help, does it?
Well, this is it. Would you hit a man in 3D glasses? Yes, I would. Now, one man who I would love to see to take the podium, but I'm not sure will, is our own Armando Iannucci, a film that we've been tracking here on Film Weekly since it premiered in Sundance this time last year. His In the Loop, a scabrous look at British politics, which I think has repercussions as we speak, Zan, as the Chilcot inquiry into Iraq goes on, and the machinations of the characters in the Loop look ever more real. Armando got a nomination with his scriptwriting team in the adapted screenplay category for In the Loop.
This is a weird one, isn't it? I think technically it qualifies as an adapted screenplay because it's a spin-off from the TV show, The Thick of It. But it's still an original material, isn't it? So it's very odd.
Unless it's adapted from life itself.
From life itself. Mm. It's adapted from the Hutton Report and the Chilcot Inquiry.
Has it got a chance of winning? I'm surprised the Americans have even seen this film.
I'm surprised too, but I hope it wins because it is one of the great British films of last year.
To read, see and hear more of Zan Brooks, go to guardian.co.uk/film. And as Zan and I were just saying, one of the great joys of the nominations list was to see In the Loop nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. And I'm delighted to say even more so that I'm now joined on the line by one of its authors and its director, Armando Iannucci. Congratulations, Armando. Now, don't get me wrong, but were you as surprised as I was to see In the Loop nominated?
It wasn't surprised to me. I mean, we'd been kind of slightly encouraged from our American distributors to at least think about it because we were... And we picked up the New York Critics Circle Award for screenplay, and we just missed the LA Critics Circle. So it was sort of being mentioned, and then it was appearing in, you know, critics' websites as one of the top five and so on. We were sort of encouraged to think about it, but not so much that actually to think about it would inevitably lead to utter disappointment.
Tell me what you're doing in the adapted category as well, because I got a bit of a surprise about that.
Well, either it's because it's adapted from the Iraq Inquiry, or I think it's because Malcolm Tucker pre-exists prior to the film in the TV show. So for that reason, it becomes adapted. I'm not going to quibble, really.
No, exactly. I mean, I know you as a greater admirer of Woody Allen, for example, who always gets nominated in screenplay category because they don't quite know what else to do with a film that's really good and might actually be clever. That this is actually a really, really good kind of notch on the old career bedpost.
There's a bit more of that going on the Oscars this year. You know, I mean, A Hurt Locker and An Education and District 9 are really good and rather clever films that are getting quite a lot of attention. So it's been an interesting year when the sort of the indies and the small scale films have kind of made as big an impact, I think, as your Transformers and the like.
Now, when we first spoke, which was about this time last year, up just before Sundance, actually, so a few weeks, kind of like, you know, we've been sort of tracking the film's progress. And each time, it's as if I sort of say to you, well, you couldn't have predicted, of course, that MPs would be, you know, worrying about their porn in their hotel bedroom. Your film
right,
sort of
pre.
And each time, and now, as I'm talking to you again, the Chilcot Inquiry is going on, and everything that your film says is
and
true.
There are startling parallels, you know, and we got the announcement yesterday just as Claire Short was saying, well, I should have resigned for now, yeah, but I chose not to, but what a fool I was. But then the film, it sort of comes as no surprise because, you know, we spent a lot of time researching the background to what really did go on 6 or 7 years ago and actually drip fed it, sometimes subtly, sometimes not so, into the storyline of the film. You know, things I was being told, but which, you know, no one was prepared to say publicly, so we just made it fiction. And now people are beginning to say it publicly, and you know, it comes as no surprise that it tallies with the sort of the stupid comedy that we were doing.
Yeah, well, as a satirist, there surely can be no sort of better compliment than real life kind of matching what you say.
Fundamentally, I wish the war didn't happen, but that would be better.
Yes,
I think in the end.
Absolutely. Well, I don't blame you for the war, Armando. I'm one of those.
I'm one of those that
doesn't believe it was your fault.
Thank you. I'm sure someone will at some point when they confuse fact with fiction. Oh, I'm being waved away. I'm in Stockholm, about to go through security.
All right. Well, I don't want you to get frisked for Film Weekly. Listen, I'll just congratulate you and leave it there, Armando, and wish you the best of luck on Oscar night. We're rooting
Thank
for
you. Thank
you
very much.
Will you swear on stage if you win?
Oh, I'll bring up my own bleeper, I think. I think a portable bleeper.
Excellent. Good luck and congratulations again.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
A huge thanks to Armando Iannucci there for breaking off a very busy schedule to talk to us, but we have been championing his film since the very start. That's all for this week. For more ruminations on the Oscars, do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday for my Trailer Trash column. The music you've been listening to throughout Film Weekly comes from the soundtrack to Invictus, Clint Eastwood's film. The music is by his son, Kyle Eastwood, working with Michael Stevens. That's it from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps. It's goodbye, and we'll see you next week.